So it's a nominally assigned subject today, which is this large photo at the end of the gallery there by a German photographer called Thomas Rook. And so what I'm going to do is not talk too much about stars and astronomy, because I'm going to leave that to Dennis. I'm just going to talk more about this artist's work and introduce it and give a brief kind of overview of what his main interest as a photographer is, and eventually work my way up to that image and just say a few words about that. So, you know, to begin with, if you've stood in front of that photo, you'll know already that, you know, it's a pretty lavish object. It's a pretty opulent object. It's a kind of a, it strikes you as a kind of a luxury commodity. It's a very perfect production value. Thomas Rowe, all his work is like this. Everything strikes you as immaculate and highly formalized and very easy to love and super easy on the eye. And, you know, I thought for a long time that that's all his work had to offer, which for me as an art historian actually is kind of boring. You can't get beyond the eye to the mind. You sort of soon run out of interest. But, you know, having been assigned to talk about his work, I started looking into the other things he's done, and what I learned was that there's a sort of conceptual thread that runs through his work, and it's about how photography functions, and he's forever examining how photography functions in all the different series of works that he does. So he's forever switching subject matter, but his idea, he's got this kind of idée fixe about photography and the way it functions. And the thing that he's fascinated with is how photography can never be objective and neutral. It can never be just a simple and straightforward document of the world around us. This is a very complicated issue to get into, so I'm going to try and step lightly and make it clear what I mean by objectivity and neutrality and things like that. Maybe just to set up what I'm going to say, we can consider a sort of very intuitive understanding of the difference between paintings and photographs. We think of paintings mostly as being sort of rooted in the subjective experience of an artist, and so they reflect that artist's personality and temperament and interests and things like that. And if we look at this Van Gogh, you know, very well-known painting, it's of the starry night sky, and of course it doesn't really look like the sky would ever strike us in real life. Whereas if we stand in front of that photograph, it's a very credible likeness of the sky, even with the naked eye, although this photograph actually was taken by a 100-inch telescope. So, you know, we have this very simple and intuitive opposition. Paintings are subjective, photographs are objective. Now, of course, it's more complicated than that, because if we go down to that gallery and look at some of the other photos there, we see images of the night sky that, although taken with a camera, don't really look like the night sky looks to us. They have these long, streaking trails in them where satellites have passed over, or, you know, things like that. Or even if we look at the rough photograph, we get stars with a sort of cruciform formation in them, which Dennis tells me is a sort of artifact of the glass and the telescope.
Yeah, the aperture size and that.
Yeah, so, you know, again, it's subtly departs from how the night sky might look to us. But what Thomas Rook was interested in is not really how a photograph might sort of slightly distort what the camera sees with respect to how we might see it with our eyes. He's more interested in the fact that photographs are never objective, because they always serve a certain purpose, and they're always rooted in the sort of interests and desires of photographers. You know, a camera might faithfully record to the best of its capacity what's going on in front of it without really making any judgments, but there's always a person who set the camera up, and that person's needs and interests are always somehow present in the finished photograph. So in that sense, photographs are a bit like a Van Gogh painting, even if it's often more subtle. And this is the idea that Thomas Rook is forever exploring in all sorts of different photographic series. Now, this is not by Thomas Rook, this is by a guy called Carl Blossfeld, who worked in the 20s and 30s. And he sort of worked at the intersection of scientific and art photography, and so does Thomas Rook. He makes these photographs that can look very as though they have a very documentary quality to them, but they're also highly formalized in the way an highly formalized. And Thomas Roth worked with a couple of art professors in Dusseldorf called the Beckers, and they spent a lifetime documenting the industrial structures of Germany, dividing them into various building types and producing a kind of atlas of these building types, which would have continued to disappear from the German landscape as they aged. And what they worked really hard to do is find a kind of neutral and objective seeming format for every photograph that they took. So what we see here is each of these water towers occupies about the same amount of frame in every case. We get a pretty frontal, front and center kind of view of what's within the frame. And what's less easy to see is they've made an effort to make sure that we're more or less at eye level with what we're looking at. We might be slightly lower or slightly higher if the terrain kind of obliged them to have a certain viewing angle, but they sort of carried a ladder and went up and down the ladder, and to the best of their ability, they made this all look very neutral. So this idea of photographic neutrality is always sort of quite carefully constructed, and this is something that Thomas Roth is also interested in.
There's one that's really different. I'm just trying to think whether it's much bigger or much smaller.
Yeah.
It's much bigger because it's taken with the beams that curves both the top and the bottom so much in the center middle.
Yeah.
Was that in an effort to bring it into the scale of the others?
I would think so. Possibly they couldn't back up as far as they wanted to.
Oh, yes, that's right. They might have been in a confined space.
Yeah, so they could never really get it perfect. Mm-hmm. They always tried to homogenize everything. Now, given that photographs can never be completely objective and neutral, Thomas Roth kind of responds to this in two ways, with two different groups of works. In the first group of works, he really just plays up the camera's capacity for artifice to generate effects that he just finds interesting or aesthetic or things like that. And this is from a series of pornographic pictures. He grabs them JPEGs on the internet and then reprints them in enormous size, having manipulated them in certain ways to mostly to blur them and to manipulate the colour and things like that. So he just willfully embraces the capacity for artifice that photographs have. Now, you know, you might wonder why he's chosen to work with pornographic images. And one reason for this, I think, is that pornographic images sort of have this idea attached to them that they show everything. You know, it's the point of pornography, nothing is hidden. So you kind of get as much of what's in front of the camera as is possible. And so what he's saying is that you can never really get everything with a camera, so we might as well forget this idea, and he's submitted them to these very obviously artificial processes. He's also worked with low-res JPEGs, again, grabbed off the internet, but he blows them up so you can see how heavily pixelated they are, and because these images have been compressed, variable kind of focus to them, which is an artifact of the compression process. But yeah, once you blow them up to an enormous size, comparable to that star photograph, they sort of, it takes on an aesthetic dimension that's kind of interesting. And he's always using subjects that speak to sort of military conflicts, battle plans, or things like that, as a commentary on how we can never get the full picture about scenarios like that. And in a really recent series, which seems totally abstract, he's rendered pictures of magnetic fields generated according to certain equations, which I have no understanding of whatsoever, but apparently these derive from those equations, and they're rather beautiful. There's another strand of his work, and it's the star photograph belongs to this strand, where it's much less obvious that photography is incapable of total neutrality. And these are ones that almost seem to play up documentary, but when you examine them further, the sort of sense of neutrality begins to break down or just grow a little bit strange. And this is a very early series he did of portraits. They're over life size when you look at them, and you know, you get the frontality of sort of a passport ID photo. So on the one hand, it's promising to you know, identify a person fully and faithfully. But on the other hand, the more you look at them, the stranger they look, and the more they depart from our appearance of one another when we interact with one another. I mean, it's seldom the case when you stand in front of another human being that every aspect of them is in sharp focus, and you're sort of only aware of them from here up. And they don't necessarily stare at you with such fixed intensity and things like that. So even when, on one hand, the camera's reality effect is maximised, the more time we spend with the supposedly highly realistic image, the odder it starts to seem.
It's better than a passport photograph, though, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's a better camera, and you spend hours getting the image.
What size? I know these are quite big, so is it about the size of that screen, or is it?
I think they might be bigger.
Yeah, so larger scale.
Yeah, the face kind of becomes a strange landscape if you get close enough to the photograph, for sure. So he did a series related to the star photos called the Mars series, and they're these absolutely beautiful Martian landscapes, and again he used found images from the internet, but the images he worked with were originally black and white, and he's digitally coloured them, so you get this sort of the stunning vision of the Martian landscape that feels deeply compelling, and he's done some seriously beautiful pictures, but all of the colour is just kind of quasi-imaginary.
Is the difference in tone and quasi-imaginary, or in the black and white, was it the dark area in the centre?
I believe it would have been in the original. He was fairly faithful to the contrast. But I mean, in the end, he just reserves the right to do pretty much what he wants. Which brings me to the star photos. The source of all these photos are negatives from an observatory in Chile that the European Union funds. And from the mid-70s to the late 80s, they had a project to sort of fully map the night sky using what was then the best kind of telescope with the best available photographic film, the most sensitive film. And Ruff got hold of a number of these negatives and produced his own photographs on this enormous scale, and I'm sure he felt free to sort of digitally adjust the tone and even things out and maybe sharpen things where he felt he wanted to. But the result is an image that looks very much like a highly objective, highly neutral picture of the sky, and it's part of an Atlas project that's aimed for a comprehensive view of the sky over the course of a number of images. But what he did to sort of subtly subvert this right at the end is he hand-rendered a single star somewhere in each of the images, so that if you go down there, you can spend the rest of your life looking for a fake star. And this is kind of like the fly in the ointment that serves as the symbol to tell us that it's always more complicated than with photography. It's never a matter of simply having this surrogate image of the world that might as well be an image of the world. Always other factors in play, and those other factors limit photography's capacity for objectivity.
Could we have Dennis's comment on this?
Yes.
Well, I mean, I don't know all the stars in the sky. You'd be surprised to know.
Yes. No, but it looks funny.
That's false. That's false. And so is that.
Okay.
That's fairly real. That looks pretty real, because that's, when you get bright stars, they show up the effect of having an aperture. I mean, you look at, even though these objects are a long way away, so the light coming towards you is a plane wave, you have to pass it through an aperture, and pretty much all telescopes have an aperture plus a mirror in the middle. So these spikes are related to the two cross pieces, the two pieces that hold the mirror in the middle. So that, I mean, that's, you can get distributed light effects, but I mean, that and that.
Do you think they're completely fabricated, or do you think?
Yeah, well, he's probably taken a star, maybe a bright star. That looks like a bit of a bright star and then added structure.
Yeah, it's probably galaxies, and yes, just increase the contrast or something.
Yeah, that's right. I don't, yeah, it's possible. Well, yeah, I mean, it could, you do get, but at that, this star field, there's not a lot of galaxies that are bright as that.
Isn't it?
Well, that's what I mean. He probably has increased the brightness of those, just to make them...
Possibly, yeah, but I mean, but if he did it by hand, the question is, how did he do that?
But isn't it true, though, Luke, that Ruff stays quite faithful to the original photograph, so that he doesn't do much in the way of manipulation, apart from the one crucial detail of adding the star, which is...
Certainly the other photos in the series are much less eventful than this. This one gets reproduced a lot because it is eventful, which suggests that maybe there was quite a lot going on.
That, I mean, that looks pretty realistic to me. There's not much
realistic,
just apart from
next these, as well
these bits, yeah.
But you could easily check just by getting your own photograph of the same area.
Yep. Yeah, well, it doesn't tell you which one it
all
is.
All you need to do is
super. Yeah, well, yeah, sure. But I mean, if he hasn't told you which one he did, that's going to be some...
And also...
Some
it would only take me about 10 seconds if they were the same size, maybe 2 seconds.
Yeah, but it'd take you more than 10 seconds to find out which region of the sky he was looking at.
Oh, yeah, that would be the thing. You'd have to get hold of the negative.
Yeah.
What makes me wonder what the point of manipulating images like that. I mean, what he's saying is something about photography, saying nothing about the cosmos or what's in the sky, is it?
Well, I think the level at which the work engages the cosmos, because obviously the subject matter is not 100% random, is at a kind of aesthetic level. He's a weird one. Producing an image in a size like that, if you're down there with that image, and the lighting weren't quite so star, you kind of get lost in the image. So when art writers at least engage these works, they use phrases like cosmic grandeur, cosmic awe, you know, if you're in a room with them.
Yeah, of course, but I mean, any astro, you know, any photograph,
sure,
an astro photographer's taken will do that for you, won't it?
I'd say yes and no, depending on the sort of formal material values for myself. Like, you know, when they show those Hubble images or galactic images that sort of haven't been processed in any way yet, they don't do that much for me. But when the artifice kicks in, that's when they start to look kind of awesome to me.
Yeah.
So there's kind of this aesthetic surplus that's added to a scientific image whose primary purpose obviously is not aesthetic, but research oriented.
So I think, one of the things I think you're right, you don't say much about the stars, but one of the things that comes across with Ruff's work, and I think one way it makes it quite infuriating, is there's a strong kind of questioning, if you like, or a certain kind of querulousness about the ethical responsibilities that come with photography. And that's something that, I mean, you mentioned the pornography pictures earlier, and one kind of expanded definition of the pornographic gaze or the pornographic image is the gaze or the image which does not take responsibility for its sources. You know, if you think outside of sort of the obvious thing, think of pornography as being sexually explicit. You think about sort of expanding the definition of pornographic to say, you know, images of violence outside the sort of sort of sexualized. Is the gaze or the look which does not have any sense of ethical responsibility?
Sure, it would be and gossip. So, gossip.
Yeah, exactly. It's the goal, and it's the image which does not want to acknowledge the means by which it's achieved or gained. And I think all the sort of children, if you like, of the method, in that sense, have at some level questioned or sort of wanted to kind of fly in the face, you know, kill the father, as it were, in terms of that training and that sort of objectiveness. Or the idea that, even if you're just photographing old chimneys and water towers, you have some sort of ethical responsibility to the viewer, to the subject matter, to get it right in the way that you know, is defined by, you know, whether it's sort of the tradition of the new objectivity and Rossfeld and surrounding, whether it's some kind of social or political responsibility or whatever it is.
Sure.
In Ruff's work, there's always been that sort of sense that I'm not going to do that. And I think it's there in Gursky, I think it's there in a number of the lesser famous photographers who have sort of started to light things with coloured lights or digitally manipulate or whatever, and a sort of deliberate attempt to sort of not do what it's supposed to do.
I pretty much agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, where that leaves us, I don't know, but I think it is this question of these pictures are about a questioning of the ethical responsibility of the photographer, perhaps. an endless kind of mischief around sort of truth-telling capacity in the image.
Well, I'd say that, you know, there are different levels, obviously, different things in play, and the ethical dimension's totally there. In fact, it's at the ethical level that I find Ruff's work a bit troubling, because at the end of the day, say, the pornographic pictures, he's just aestheticized pornography, which seems to be an uncritical response to the subject matter, whereas with his JPEGs, which sort of interrogate the media experience of war and conflict, he does seem to be taking an ethical stance. So, yeah, I feel there's the resolution in his work. Whereas Gursky, as far as I can tell, really just does uncritically embrace spectacle. There's not much that I can detect in his work that runs against
it. I suppose, well, a picture of the Brian is difficult if we talk about what it's not. But I think probably where Gersten for me has the edge is, I mean, the picture of the Rhine, which is hilarious because for me, I think it's just a flat, it looks like a canal. For those of you who have seen the sky, there's green grass on the far side, there's a line of water, and there's green grass on the picture. And so effectively what you've got is the most unromantic, unspectacular image of this great river, so the longest river in Europe. Possibly have. There's no sense of history, no sense of spectacle or anything. And in that sense, a kind of deliberate attempt to be sort of very deflationary about it, sort of, you know, pop the myth kind of thing, the balloon of the myth. In one
well,
sense,
as I did take out a whole lot of buildings on the sky.
Yeah, but in that sense, it's sort of it's just the water. Perhaps there's something going on there, which is more than this. But to me, this is more of a piece. I think what's interesting is this generational attempt to. Becomes the new subjectivist rather than the new objectivist, or the new objectivist.
I think we'd probably be secure in saying they just at least what they wanted to do is complicate the terms of what the members did.
Dennis, I wonder just on a sort of very simple level, if there is something in the scientist in you that kind of balks at the idea of an artist taking this photographic image of the night sky and putting his own star and a fabricated star. Is there something that as a scientist you just immediately find kind of worrying and troubling about that?
Well, no, it's not worrying, but I mean if it was available as a star chart you wanted to use to find something,
yeah,
that'd be a bit annoying. There's extra glob in there. Although you find that the photographs, whether they be electronic or not now, there's sometimes artifacts in there anyway. So, you know, that's obviously a representation of, I don't know what the scale is, it'll be, it won't be as big as a degree, but it depends on how long the exposure was, but those two objects there wouldn't be a bother because you wouldn't see them, and you're used to seeing artifacts, but I suppose it doesn't really do that much for me for some character. This is the scientist to come along and here's a picture, so I'll frig around with it a bit and call it art. I'd call it crap, just in that context. But I mean, there are other the distorted images of objects. You know, that's a little bit different. I suppose this doesn't really leave me cold. It just sort of leaves me neutral. I think, well, why bother?
I just find it
less interesting somehow. You find it interesting?
Less interesting than the real thing. That's because I'm fascinated by the real thing.
Yeah.
And now I'm just looking at somebody's invention.
Yeah.
And okay, fine, but you know, I'll move on.
Well, that probably actually plays back into what I was saying about this work and photographs always serving certain interests and desires.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what a photograph isn't part of the function of what we want from it or need from it.
No, but it's what he wants from it, and
yeah,
it doesn't coincide
exactly
with what I want from it, and
exactly,
that's fine, but I just wouldn't spend much time
sure
looking at it.
But hasn't there always been a history of manipulation with early photographic images, right, from making them more contrasty. Yes. And you walk around the gallery and you see the unmanipulated. So there was always this element of the hand, which goes back into photography as being truthful or not.
It's one of the attractions of photography is to be able to see what people don't see. You have both opposite sides of the night sky, the foil, the photograph of himself as if he was dead, portrait of a dragon. You know, the wish just to see himself with his eyes closed from start, and to see himself as if he was dead. So there is that sort of aspect of photography which is always kind of wanted in photography as a place to object to.
Yeah, I take the point that, you know, when you take a photograph, that it isn't a perfect representation of what's there. It's going to be different from what you see by your eye. So, I mean, one point, I guess he's trying to that aspect of photography explicit. There'll always be artifacts that are introduced by the mechanism you use to take the photo. So, and I mean, there used to be a saying, seeing is believing, but with modern electronic photographs and programs to manipulate them, that seeing and believing is not true anymore. They can make anything they like.
But it never was true, because it was just more laborious to make these manipulations.
Yeah.
In the dark room, you know, look at Soviet images where suddenly unwanted people disappeared from the dark. Because they were no longer regarded presentable.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to do now, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Everybody can do it. Yes.
That particular image depends a lot, though, doesn't it, on the fact that you're informed that it was the sky? What happens if you didn't know it was on the sky, but you say it was the sky?
Well, it'd be pretty obvious.
It'd be a piece of granite with the micro reflections there. I think it replicates.
Yep. You're not wrong.
It doesn't have to be the sky.
No, you're quite right.
It could be just aesthetically pleasing image, whatever it is.
I mean, it could be purely abstract.
Yeah. And see, lots of images are done nowadays like that. You don't necessarily have to be told what the image is. Forget about what it's supposed to be of. That's irrelevant in art. It's really, it can be relevant, but it doesn't have to be.
Yeah,
I don't necessarily see that from where I'm sitting here, I suppose, down there.
Yeah.
Is that in the night sky? I've been told it is, but is it?
Yeah.
I don't know. There's things that look like it because of the cross shapes, and you know, you're familiar with optics and how it works.
Sure.
But as far as I'm concerned, he could have done it all by hand.
That's why it's so expensive.
Yeah. It's really easy to do.
So even though he made a manipulation to it, even if he hadn't, we're still not really seeing exactly what's really there anyway. Even the lens, not the lens piece, but the little doodads, they're not there in reality.
No. Well, it also raises the question of what isn't there in reality, because
so maybe we need
independent of our perceptions of it, there's always some sort of mediation.
Well, also, actually, if you gazed up at that, if a picture of the sky of some dimension, if you gazed up at it now, I mean, you don't see what's there, because the light takes a long time to come from there to there. So, I mean, for example, the nearest star, other than our sun, the light takes something like 4 years travelling at the speed of light to get here. So, you're looking back in time, and the bigger the telescope to bring up the faint images, the further you're looking back. So it's sort of you think, oh, it's there. Well, in fact, you're seeing light photons that have been travelling a long time to get to you from different distances.
And then we don't see the other because we can't see in,
there's a distribution. It's interesting. So what?
The objectivity is interesting, isn't it? And I just wonder if artists are missing an opportunity. I mean, this is the interesting thing about this exhibition. It's like the interface between art and science, which, by the way, I think is a false dichotomy. But if I produce an image and I say, look, there's the Higgs boson, which, by the way, there's an announcement about that due to that, and it's based on images, like there's the Higgs boson. Now, what will happen is people will go, oh, no, it's not. I can't go and reproduce another image like that to say there's the Higgs boson. So the subjectivity is factored out by other people looking at the same thing. It's Karl Popper or someone like that said. That's the point about science. Any subjective bias is factored out by other people involved in the process.
Kind of looking at verification.
Yeah, so that's the whole idea, isn't it, of running, replicating experiments. So I do an experiment, get a result, can other people replicate that experiment? So my subject bias is factored out through that whole process.
On the editorial board.
But even he mentioned the Higgs boson, if it's real, I mean, it won't be a sort of picture of something. It'll be tracks in a bubble chamber, and you know that are related back to some event which they say happened. So it's an even more remote, actually.
I was on a panel a while ago at Cambridge Church and College when UK Astronomy Centre, and it was in the panel giving artists and scientists, and one of the scientists was saying that we were talking about the colorized images. Space telescope, you know, obviously the sense that these are false colour images. And the artists were particularly kind of vexed by this. And the art historians would sort of say, well, this raises all sorts of ethical issues. The scientists, on the other hand, would say that it brings in funding, educates people about science, it spreads the method. I won't say mercenary, that's too much of a fact, but certainly very utilitarian about it. But also, if it does the job, people are going to be turned off by black and white images of the night sky, and if they're going to be turned on by colour images of the Orion Nebula or whatever, then I'm all in favour of the colour images. End of discussion.
They looked at the northern and the southern lights, and if you want some more of that, to get some funding, and that was the basis on which they proceeded.
Yeah, but it's not totally. Many of the colourised images are an attempt to reproduce what you'd see if you're closer to the objects and outside the atmosphere. So it's not just, I'm not saying all colourised images, but many of them, they make an attempt to, for example, there was a chap at the Anglo-Australian Telescope, he used to take lots of photographs of Australia, of different nebula and galaxies, and he took them through three broad colour filters and then reconstituted the photograph in what is effectively false colour, but it was a genuine attempt to represent what you'd see if you're outside the atmosphere of Earth and viewing it from a reasonable distance, right? So it's not just to sort of make it look nice.
Maybe, but there was a paper presented, I believe the lady's called Diane Kessler, I might be wrong, she did a paper some time ago now about the closer creation image from the Nebula. And she pointed out that, I mean, obviously there's no reason why the closer creation should look very much like the boots in the Midwest, the Western
Indies. Yes.
And she drew direct parallels between whether it was on a conscious or an unconscious level, between the way that these images are being presented from the telescope and the Hudson River School of Painters of the American West. And in similar ways, I mean, Donovan Morton has made the point about the correlation between Arizona and Mars. There's no reason, obviously, as we all know, why Arizona should be regarded as a parallel to Mars. The obvious parallel, if there is another parallel point, is the dry valley in Antarctica. But nevertheless, for ideological reasons, these things become kind of seen as somehow related, you know, in terms of Arizona and Mars, and likewise even they were in the school painters, etc. So her point was that even if on one level you might see these things, expertise, but on the other hand, there was this decision making about the way images are presented that quite clearly is informed by certain ideological, cultural interests, etc.
Yeah, I mean, you can't have an interest-free image. It's probably what it boils down to. Whether we need to be clearly concerned about that or not is a side issue.
But haven't they just shown us what we see? We can have the limitation of not being able to. Like when we go outside and moonlight, it all looks, not terribly bright in moonlight, it all looks pretty grey. And we know it's not, because if we go out in the daytime, we have green grass and blue sky. So if these images are showing us what we see, if we could accumulate enough light over time, is that false, or is it just compensating for our physiological limitations?
It's compensation with respect to something that we've decided as a kind of natural baseline, that at the end of the day we've nominated that as a baseline, for example, that you've given. We're not obliged to
make that our standard of reference, right?
No, but I don't mind if people do, because it shows me what the actual wavelengths are like that.
I certainly don't mind either, but the point I'm making is that, an interest-derived decision is made to call that our baseline and calibrate with respect to that. It's not neutral in any sort of eternal platonic absolute sense. And, you know, there's one point of view about science that sort of brackets the idea of whether science tells us what reality is like in and of itself, independently of us, and simply as this very useful means we've discovered for predicting and controlling our experience in better and better ways. And from that standpoint, we stop having answers to what things are sort of like in our absence, or things like that, or we stop even posing that question because it sort of stops making sense.
So that, would you say that, that's a phrase I've heard recently, would you say all science is human science?
Yeah, I mean, you probably want to pin a specific meaning to that sentence, but that, you know, that sounds pretty good. And that also allows the possibility for its other kinds of sciences, depending on how we want to understand science.
We all have biases in our color vision. My right eye sees warmer than my left eye. Drives you nuts. You don't know which one is correct.
But the point is,
you know what is correct.
The point is, I can come along and you say that's red, and I say it's green, and the third person can come along and say, oh, that's green. So therefore, what you say, and then the fourth person comes along and says that's green.
Green color blindness, right?
Yeah.
But in normal vision, there is still a bias about cooler and warmer. Always. There always is. I figured out what mine was doing my floaters. I had a veil in my eye that made everything warmer.
I've got the same without the floaters. I find it interesting. I don't mind it at all. It just shows me that we
need
different.
Yeah, so the standard you have to judge by is always not narrowly defined. You know, normal, that's about 6,000 degrees Kelvin. We'll accept that as a standard. Step into the shade, you've changed it.
But then you see the photograph differently from me anyway.
Mm.
So what
do you mean?
Yeah.
You can argue with your color processor.
What do the physicists think of that phrase, all science is human science?
Sorry, do what?
All science is human science. What do you think about that, Dennis? Or do you think there is some platonic objectivity? So that if an alien came and saw that starfield, they would see exactly what, except for the artificial images, would they see exactly the same thing?
I think there's a genuine, real attempt to be objective in science, you know, based on measurement. There's obviously always some cultural aspect to things, like names. But I remember, you know, years ago when I was studying philosophy, one, university, and I thought, this is fabulous. There's lots of questions that are being asked, and the questions I thought of, these are great people actually asking the same questions. And so my first year at Philosophy 1, till about halfway through the course, I was enraptured. But then I was reading through this book, and I got fed up with sort of always asking, am I here, or are we there? And I think it's Descartes, the philosopher, I think it's his quote. You know, I think, therefore I am. I think, yeah! Stop all this arguing about whether I am or am not here. And so that sort of put philosophy into a sort of box for me. But there's still metaphysics in terms of, you know, well, what are the real underlying things? But since it's based on observation and experiment, and there's, if you look in the history of science throughout you know, the last couple of 200-300 years, there's sort of an evolution from all different cultures agreeing on a set of concepts, you know, which can be tested in terms of observation and experiment. So it is pretty much removed from any cultural thing. So I think any alien out there would make the same sort of measurements and come to the same sorts of general rules and laws. They'll have different names, but they're sort of fundamental things, the way the universe seems to work, that science is discovering. you know, and so I think that, you know, it is quite objective. It's one of the things I like about it. Not always.
Is it objective in the sense of telling us things, showing us things as they are, full stop, or as I was kind of suggesting before, is what we're doing simply learning to predict and control our experience in ways that seem even more expansive and helpful to us?
Well, I think it's objective in the sense that they're, I like to think of them as sort of working models. You know, there was, not that long ago, an experiment that suggested that the particles of neutrinos travel faster than the speed of light. You know, and the headlines of the papers were, Einstein wrong. Well, you know, now even if that experiment was just verified and it did produce a problem, Einstein wouldn't have been wrong. Because there's a sort of sequence of models. Newton's not wrong. You know, things get modified as you go into different, more extreme areas. So our sort of, my particular view is that, you know, we have working models of the world that represent what happens and we can predict things. You know, if you're building a car, an aeroplane, you don't need Einstein's general relativity, or you need essentially Newtonian law. And the complications beyond that, such as how fluids flow, are much more complicated. So a whole set of working models is the way I think about it. And I'm also influenced by some of the scientists have said, for example, physics has the luxury of, in a sense, of concentrating on simpler things. As you go from simpler things to much more complicated entities, like biological entities, you have, you know, the things are much more complex. So I don't think, I mean, physics will never totally answer, that's my view, of what happens in complex biological systems. You have a whole set of new models. And the break starts as you move from physics into more complicated chemistry. Organic chemistry is already complicated. And in theory, physics rules should be able to predict it. But the way they've made progress is they have a whole set of tools of working models to understand how the complex organic molecules organise and do things. So I think it'll always sort of remain like that myself.
And how would you know in principle that the model was complete and accurate?
Well, I think it'll never be totally complete at one level, but it's adequate. For example, we already know that Newton's laws that relate to motion, acceleration, mass, etc., are wrong at some point. But at the level of understanding how an aircraft works, how cars move, we don't need the extensions that would change, fundamental extensions that Einstein first added. And then down in the very small, there's quantum mechanics. So, but we don't actually need that in a lot of the areas we work. So in a sense, you could argue it will never be totally complete.
And present, like, if I have a real aeroplane, and I've got a couple of plastic models of it, and I want to figure out which one's accurate model, right? I have the ability to see the real aeroplane and the two plastic ones potentially sort of together in the same place, and I can compare them and decide that this one, maybe the wing measurements are wrong,
yeah,
they got the decals wrong or something, so I can make that comparison and make a judgment about a better or a worse model. But with reality as such, I can't have reality here and then the model of physics here and independently compare the two.
Well, you do by experiment and observation. You know, if your model is predicting results that you can verify, then that model is accurate enough.
Does that tell us about how reality works, or about how our experience is?
Well, I don't know. That's
a really difficult philosophical issue.
But that thing is...
it's not. It's experiment is key.
Yeah. So if it's sort of, you know...
Do you decide by experiment?
That's basically the same situation as you comparing your model aircraft to the real thing. That's the models, physical models, are compared to what is out there. So whether the predictions actually can be confirmed or not. So which one of the models does better predict or better match what is observed?
See, for me, we're still never leaving the circle of our experience. The strongest idea of objectivity is kind of like the view from nowhere. It's reality independently
of our experience, but we don't have the ability to get out of that framework, therefore it's always going to be an open question.
But there are moments when we do break out of, say we now, I'm saying humanity, break out of, well, I mean the classic example is Kepler, surely. I mean Kepler, anyone, as Carl Sagan actually said, he summarized his life by saying he preferred the bitter truth to his dearest illusions, so that he'd spent his life trying to prove that the platonic solids somehow related to the orbits of the planets. And almost in a sense, Kepler's laws of motion come out of a kind of byproduct, a sort of side, what he thought was a side issue of his main scientific work. Nevertheless, that side issue does kind of crack the shell.
We can get into these big seismological shifts in the patterning of our experience. I think we can have these very big seismological shifts in the patterning of our experience and how we understand that. But again, it's all taking place at the level of our experience without the possibility of sort of non-anthropomorphic verification or something like that.
But effectively, the point where Kepler breaks through and realizes that his life's work is spoken, basically, that at that point he realizes also that there is something else out there. He touches the fact that there is another truth, as it were, a value, a set of values which he has ignored or was not aware of, but he acknowledges that existence. He acknowledges a sort of possibility of another ontological.
Sure, and we do it all the time, and intuitively, right?
Well, we just increased our knowledge the other day by increasing the length of the day by 1 second. It's through Qantas' computers. Iraq. And that's what they blame it on, and they accommodated it, but the day is longer by 1 second, according to what happens to the Earth's rotation.
No, but we know all about that. They're thinking of getting rid of the leap second, because it's more trouble than it's worth.
Well, they get the leap minute.
Well, the day, the civil day, is based on the rotation rate of the Earth, and compared to the atomic clocks, there's a difference, right? And so the Earth is gradually slowing down erratically. But the idea of adding the leap second was to keep it within seconds, every half year. But there's a move now to let's get rid of it, because why worry about the fact we might be 10 minutes out 400 years from now? But the International Astronomical Union couldn't make their mind up. There was a meeting earlier this year where there was one group, the US and some other countries, thought either we keep with it or we don't. And the Europeans and someone else thought, well, I think we'll change it. So they've deferred the decision.
Why can't we do it every leap year and enforce it?
Well, it's just, but it's arbitrary. I mean, the fact that I think there's, since in the last 20 years, there's 35 leap seconds out. So, I mean, it could be done every year, but the decision was to do it every half year when relevant. So it's a sort of bit esoteric,
Sorry? What are the arguments for not having seconds?
Well, it's just a damn nuisance, really. And such we don't live our life by seconds. And I heard about this problem that one of my students told me. He's a good computing interested guy. And he said that it's to do with the Linux operating system. There's two ways of timing things. So a number of servers did crash, apparently, because they hadn't taken into account that the leap second will be added. And one method of timing how programs are run was a second out, and that didn't work anyway. It was a funny business.
Well, but we'll be going through that during the Olympics. People will have their lives determined by 1 second.
Yeah, well, we don't live our lives by 1 second. Well, yeah, but so.
But everybody will be equally.
Over 20 years since we've added 30 years, 35 leap seconds, who cares? I mean, it's a damn nuisance. Let's wait until it's significant. But then the argument will be, wait, and then suddenly it's a quarter of an hour out. But that'll be...
that'll be way more interesting.
Pardon?
Then you'd really be late.
Yeah. So, anyway, you can see the boffins. I'm not sure if I was on the Boffin committee whether I'd argue one way or the other, but sure.
Yes, I just wonder if, because I'm aware that time is running out, we've had a request that that you could speak directly to this idea of starlight.
All right, yeah, I'll show. Shall I show some pictures?
Yeah, that would be great.
Pictures? Okay, yeah. I think I need to. I just collected some pictures and a few things together that I'll let's see if this works. And you can judge their artistic merit. Yeah, okay, so we're talking about starlight and essentially all observations are through telescopes. And nowadays you don't look through telescopes at objects, you take electronic pictures. So that's actually a picture at Mount John University Observatory, which back in 2004 I used, that's in the South Island of Twilight. There's a big telescope that I'm part of a collaboration down at Mount John. That's a moonlit version of it. There's a group called Moore, which does work. That's a picture of twilight in Chile. It won't be the same observatory that was that took the photographs that are part of that painting, but that's that's just taken by a simple electronic camera, which I think is quite artistic. Probably win an award, but anyway, it's that telescope actually. They're 6.5 metre in diameter. They're one of the big, they're bigger telescopes than that, but I had an opportunity to make use of that. That's up at Mauna Kea Observatory. Twilight again, which is 40,000 feet on the Big Island of Hawaii. I was there observing 10 years ago, not using that telescope. That's the Japanese telescope. There's the Keck telescope, one of the Keck telescopes is on the right. Okay, so here's a star field, and it's so that you don't waste black ink, it's better to, or black carbon, it's better to reverse the photograph and make the stars, you know, make a negative of it or a positive of a negative. Now that's a field of view from one of these sky surveys, which has made locating objects of interest relatively easy now. When I got involved in astronomy decades ago, if you were trying to follow a star that someone had said did something of interest, you know, finding which star was a problem. But now it's actually quite simple, relatively, because there's online, there's a whole lot of these star fields that you can download. You can precisely download the bit such that the middle is the exact coordinate of interest. So that's actually 20 arc minutes, which is a third of a degree by a third of a degree, and the bit that I was interested in there, that size there is what I can see with an instrument down at Mount John, electronic camera, and so you can see that's a real star, but I mean those artifacts are, as I said, due to taking a picture through a circular aperture, and there's support structure that holds a mirror in the middle. Because most telescopes actually have, they're reflecting telescopes, so the light comes in, the light comes back up, and then you can either have something up at what's called prime focus, or you can put another mirror there and reflect the light back down again and do various things. So there's always something for a reflecting telescope essentially in the road, and this structure supports it. So the star, I spent a long time looking at this, and the interesting thing is if you need a finding chart, because you know, if you look at this field and say, well, hang on, which one are we talking about? So the pattern recognition is quite important. And then if I take that Sorry?
No, you're right.
Yeah, so if you look at the star that I was interested in, is right down the bottom hand corner, the bright one, there's three together. And if you go back, if you look at this, because that was on the really big telescope, it's this, and this. That's the one there. That one. So that field is of these guys there. And if you're on a bigger telescope with a better field of view, we could see that object. Anyway, so, I mean, that's a picture off from the electronic camera that I use. And what we're interested in is how the light changes from that particular guy down below there. It's actually a white dwarf star. Okay, now here's another picture. This is taken with that big blue-coloured telescope. Each of those rectangles corresponds to a 2,000 by 4,000 electron pixel camera, CCD, and extent. So this is a picture looking towards the Milky Way in the centre of the galaxy. There's huge numbers of stars. So that's a program I'm involved in where you monitor the light output from lots of those stars. You can only do it electronically with a lot of computer power now, and you're looking for specific changes. And the sort of changes of that goes back some years. That's if you look at the time scale here, that's 2 days, and this is the light from a particular star is magnified up near 600 times. If you're going to have a 24-hour coverage, I mean the sun comes up, so you have observers from different observatories trying to observe the same thing, and the line there is a model fit. That star went up and down, like we missed it there. That time scale is 1 day. And that corresponded, the model of that is a star plus two planets by method called Michaelson. There's another, that's the same sort of thing, but if you look at the time scale there, the bottom panel, it's in 2 days, it's gone up. It's only gone up by a function of 1.4 times. It's one of the stars in that dense field, and it goes up and down, and you, from that you can model that it's an isolated object, which is less massive than a planet by itself. It's sort of, we call free-floating planets. Here's one that I'm really like. This is when I was in Hawaii. That's looking at light from a star, and the model is this is the light level. Maybe you have it there. That's true cloud. And there. So there's the star, and then what happens over a period of a few hours, it dipped down. This scale here is a bit more than 1%. And the model for that is that it was an extrasolar planet going in front of the star, a transit. Just like the transit of Venus. But you could detect it as a drop in light from the star of about 1%. And remember the area, it's the area, so it was a Jupiter-sized planet going in front of a star. I happened to be in the right place at the right time, actually with my son at Mauna Kea doing something else, and we were able to, in 1999, contribute to seeing this transit of an extrasolar planet, which is pretty exciting, actually. Okay, so here, well, this is a little bit more complicated. If you look at star light, now this curve here represents the light from the sun, and our eyes, this is sensitive about here, right? Your eye here goes from round about there to there. And what's sort of interesting, you know, that our eyes, I've always thought that, this is a theoretical term of what happens to the light from what's called a black body radiator. Light, photons are emitted from randomly excited material that just happens to be hot. I mean, black body is a funny term. I mean, you can have a very bright black body, but the point is that it absorbs at the same sort of efficiency as it emits. But that's the sun. And so our eyes are sort of matched. You might expect that from evolution. Our eyes are matched to the middle region where the sun is bright. So, you know, we'd see white light, largely white, but and as I said, their eyes are sensitive over this sort of wavelength region. This is that's light from a very hot star, which is 30,000 Kelvin at the surface. That's a white dwarf star, and I'm interested in, there's an object around about that sort of temperature. Now, here's another thing that you can do, is if you put the light through a device for splitting it up into different wavelengths, you can actually see that there are bits missing, you know, or bits, the light is not the same. I mean, there's this effect there, which is related to how hot it is, and then these are spectral, what are called spectral lines, and they represent elements in the atmosphere. And most of those elements there are to do with helium, because that's a helium-dominated star. And in fact, the substance helium was first discovered by analysing light from the sun. So spectroscopy, where you look in great detail at what elements, or you can infer what elements are in the atmosphere of the star, is an important, very important part of what a lot of astronomy does. You can actually look at if the lines are sharp, you can get information, and you keep observing the same object, you can see it go backwards and forwards in wavelength, and that tells you the thing's moving around. And you can also compare spectra from stationary objects to ones that are a long way away, and you can work out by the Doppler effect how much they're moving. So the spectral stuff is important. But one thing about astronomy that's interesting is you're limited to daylight at night time. You can't say, oh, well, let's just observe for longer, because the night time has a finite length. And then there's clouds. You have time on a given telescope. You're limited in aperture size. So a lot of what is done is compromised by the fact, compared with a laboratory, where in many cases you can just observe longer or go longer, whereas in astronomy you're stuck with this issue of observing for a given time using a given telescope, which has a finite aperture of a finite size. That's another version. There are two different sorts of stars there. The red spectrum was used to give the right slope for the blue spectrum. But the red spectrum has hydrogen lines, there's a hydrogen atmosphere, and the blue one has only helium. And DNA is much more complicated than spectral identification of objects, of atoms in a star, but it was the same principle. And then, here's another thing you can do. If you look at the tonal light output for a star, this is a star I'm interested in, it varies. You see that's varying by 5% up and down. There's a red line actually fits it. But you see the time scale, it's over minutes, and the light pulsates, changes in amplitude, and that's traced back to the fact that the star is quivering. And you can use the periods, the rate of change, to infer things about the structure of the star. Oh, and here's something this is an astronomy shot. I'll tell you why I've clipped. That's Venus, obviously. That's actually over the Pacific, flying from Hong Kong to Los Angeles. It's not me, it's my son. He's a pilot now. He's sort of a second officer, so he was relieving the captain. But that's obviously, because it's dawn, that's obviously Venus. I'm not sure what that is, because that was only a week ago. In the dawn sky, you could see Venus. And then a bit later, he took that shot. And I reckon that's fantastic. That's a shot of the dawn over the Pacific. It's north of the equator. It's in a Boeing 777. And that's a track, vapor trail of a plane going a little bit faster than they were Terry must say he wasn't trying to take artistic shots, but I just think that's a fabulous shot.
How do you get a vapor trail out the front of the Indians? There's something else preceded.
It's below, you know, he told me that what had happened, they knew over the Pacific. Oh, excuse me.
He's calling to correct you.
He's calling me out. Hello? I'm just showing a picture of Timmy to show you the talk. I'll call you back. Okay. No, that was my daughter. But over the North Pacific, they don't have any control tower to talk to. It's sort of, but they're told tracks they can fly along. And there was this other, probably took off from Hong Kong. He thought that this plane was from Japan because they go, and so therefore it was flying at a lower altitude because it had more fuel on board and it was a little bit faster. So, but that's so that's definitely a vapor trail, and it was going a bit faster and flew under them. So anyway, I think that's a fantastic artistic picture. So I don't care if you don't think that. But anyway, so that's so the lead in was this. That's definitely Venus up there. Anyway, I'm happy to answer any questions.
What's the speciality, especially just about white dwarfs and stars?
The sun will become a white dwarf. The predictions are that something like 98% of all stars, up to masses about 8 times the mass of the sun, end their life as white dwarfs. A white dwarf is roughly the size of the Earth and the mass of the sun, so it's incredibly dense. And part of the insides contain some of the history of what happened before. And in a particular temperature regimes, they pulsate, so you can actually investigate the structure, a bit like seismology. So there's, it's one of the branches of astronomy that you can get interested in. I've been interested in it for 20 years, and partly it's this sort of phenomenon. You can, I'm limited really by the size of the telescope. I can use 1 meter telescope in Mount China. And this is called high speed time series photometry. You need good instruments to be able to monitor. You can see this is seconds, right? You need to monitor every 20 seconds the brightness and keep following it. But then by fitting these curves and matching it to models of white dwarfs, you can sort of investigate the structure. So that's my interest.
And are they burning helium?
No, the nuclear processes have essentially finished, although some of the models suggest in the hot stages there's shell burning of hydrogen. So the primary nuclear burning phases are over. The first burning phase for most stars, all stars, starts off as long as the mass is 8% more massive than the sun, then you get hydrogen fusion in the centre. When that's exhausted, if the star isn't massive enough, it needs to be something like one type of a solar mass or half a solar mass, then helium burning takes over. And then, but for the more massive star, you need a much more massive star to get burning of material beyond that.
So what's making them glow? Sorry.
Sorry, what?
What's making them glow still?
It's residual energy and heat. Actually, what happens is the electrons that hold them up, but there's a lot of restored thermal energy. So they collapse down to something like the size of the Earth. A lot of stored energy, and the escape mechanism is heating up the surface and emitting photons from the surface. That's not entirely true in the early stages of the neutrinos, but it takes a long time for that energy to leak out, and they just slowly decay away. So when I was a teenager and sort of entering the social world, I wished I knew about this research discipline, because I could have had some fun answering questions like, what do you do? I study dwarfs. Oh, yeah. White dwarfs. But not only that, they're pulsating white dwarfs. And that'd be a real showstopper.
Were there any other questions for Luke or Dennis? Because I'm thinking we might have to.
I just want to pay a retrospective tribute to an utter fancifulness about astronomy, which has almost nothing to do with astronomy and more a reverence for what we have. And that was Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, who was also a pilot, I believe. And his little story of the Little Prince, which is ostensibly a children's book, can be read with adults with a very different eye. So I just kind of was just thinking of it as children's art, but kind of wise.
What is the book, sorry?
The Little Prince by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. No, The Little Prince. Yeah.
Yes, he has a, there is a tiny log out there on which there grows a single rose, which is of significance to him. And of course it's scientific nonsense, it's more about actual values, but he uses the idea of a little star for each, a little planet as it were, for each person to be working on, some beavering away and don't seem to know anything exists but their accounts and so on. So, I mean, this has got nothing to do with what we're doing except that it's another form of art about astronomy that